Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, John Karsibayev.
Tony Bryan, I am the Executive Director at CyberUp.
Tony, thanks so much for making time to join us on the Ivy Podcast. Very excited about the conversation that we're about to have. Before we do that and talk about all the great things you're currently building with CyberUp, tell us, give us a thumbnail version of your career prior to that.
Ooh, my thumbnail version of my career. So, I am a college dropout. I went to college after high school, didn't have a great time. I don't find that I was ready for it mentally or emotionally. After that experience, found myself in the United States Army and, you know, had a really good career in the Army, spent 9 years active duty, you know, as a military police soldier, drill sergeant duty, team leader, squad leader, lots of different jobs in that function. The op tempo of deployments, I had 4 kids at the time. Op tempo was crazy with deployments to Iraq and Afghanistan. And I didn't really see, you know, that being conducive to raising a family of 4 kids and being married. So, you know, my wife and I made the tough decision to get out, and landed into this random world of nonprofit leadership. And, you know, I've been doing this for the past nearly 14 years, and feel very fortunate to, you know, to have landed at the head of CyberUp and, you know, very proud of the work we currently do within our organization.
Well, that's super exciting. Very colorful and diverse background you have. Appreciate you sharing that. So tell us a little bit more about CyberUp. What problem are you guys solving, and essentially the types of services that are being provided?
Yeah, so CyberUp, you know, we are headquartered in St. Louis, Missouri. So in the great Midwest, I saw we made a list of, one of the top places to move to for startups and stuff. So it's a lot of great, exciting things happening in our region. So really proud to be, you know, what we call hashtag STL made here in the middle of the country. As a nonprofit, our mission is to cultivate the cybersecurity talent pipeline for today and tomorrow, right? We've all seen the statistics, or I'm assuming we've all seen the statistics that there's a massive shortage in cybersecurity talent across the country, right? And the world. I think we're well over 500,000 open roles today that are going unfilled. And so we really wanted to take both a short-term and a long-term approach at how we as a nonprofit could help solve that, and very importantly, through an equity and diversity lens, right? How do we make sure that the workforce is reflective and fair and equal for everybody to have an opportunity to get into it? So we solve that in one of two ways, right? So we have, for the short-term, an apprenticeship program. We recruit, find, train, mentor, coach, and then place individuals into apprenticeships where they, you know, work with an employer for a 1-year period. They leave that, you know, with experience, 2 industry recognized certifications, mentorship, and, you know, have gotten paid throughout the time that they've been able to do that. We do apprenticeship, you know, all across the country. We have, you know, we're very early in the adoption of apprenticeship and cybersecurity as the 3rd program in the United States. So I've been at it for just about 5 years, and, you know, I'm proud to say we have the best apprenticeship program in the country. And then the long-term approach here is, you know, we've got to get in front of middle school, high school students. They're the future. You know, it makes me think of, you know, music, you know, 80 grade 80s music, right? We are the world, we are the children. Like, that stuff's important. But really, it is a critical point, right? We've got to get kids excited about STEM activities and learning, making that fun and engaging, making sure schools have tools and resources they need to be successful. We provide that through a virtual cybersecurity competition called Power Up Cyber Games. Middle school, high school students compete. It runs throughout the school year. Each month is a different topic. They have access to a cyber gym where they get a practice, curriculum, videos, content that they get a, you know, spark an interest and really gamify, you know, learning and gain cybersecurity skills. We started that in 2020. And this is our 2nd season. So we have about 1,000 kids in 18 states right now competing. and things like cryptography, open source intelligence, Linux, and a myriad of other topics. Not intended to, you know, be a recruitment tool for us. It's, these are pathways, right? There are lots of, and we're going to talk about skills in a little bit, but there are lots of ways for you, you know, junior, senior in high school to get skills, community colleges, four-year programs, boot camps, apprenticeships. Pick which one's best for you. Here's a job. We just want to be that catalyst of, you know, inspiration for them to see it as a pathway that they can obtain and actually pursue and get to.
Wow, that's super exciting. There's so much to uncover there with everything that you guys are building. So being in cybersecurity yourself and in talent acquisition for quite some time, in terms of the trends that you're personally very excited about or the ideas that you research out there in terms of the market shifts and where things are going, share some thoughts with us from that perspective on what are the trends that you're mostly excited about.
It's been interesting to see over the past, I'd say 3 years, right? And I think COVID really kind of thrust this into the forefront. Companies are starting to look and be creative in how they're onboarding and hiring talent, right? You know, the days and age of just, you know, I'm going to have a very traditional college recruiting program and going to these five universities to get my five people, you know, or 10 people, however many it may be. You know, those days are over. There are a lot of kids. I have, you know, four, as I mentioned earlier, I have a 17-year-old who's a bright, smart kid that has zero interest in college, right? He will find other alternative ways to get a career, and he would be a great prospect for somebody to hire. So we're getting to this point where we have to look beyond just that traditional college recruitment, look at things like apprenticeship or non-traditional paths that exist out there. As a resource, we have to relook, you know, do I need a person that has a degree in a technology job? Is that a requirement or predictor of that person's success? You know, for me, college education is important, right? I think it's, you know, I was able to go back to school and get a degree. And I think it's important because it gives that individual, you know, oftentimes a little bit more control of their future, right? Because there's a large propensity of companies that don't, you know, they still do require degrees. And so like, if I'm able to check a box on a lot of those applications, then that gives me a leg up over somebody that doesn't. So, you know, that degree is important, but not always necessary to get a foot in the door. In a perfect world, you know, young man or woman is able to get a career through, you know, a non-traditional pathway, go into that employer, do a really good job in that job role, and that company pays for that person to go back to school. They have no debt, no expenses. It's paid for by their employer, right? Like, nobody wants to be hobbled with $120,000, $150,000 of student debt for the rest of their life. So it changes the narrative of how that individual can, you know, still, you know, get to the ultimate level of success with the degree.
With your companies being, you know, specializing in cybersecurity, and it's one of the most, I would say, challenging sectors when it comes to finding talent. And I would imagine that your strategy to invest heavily into training and grooming and upskilling the talent in this space is also a unique strategy to be able to compete in this extremely competitive market when it comes to finding talent in cybersecurity. Tell us a little bit more about that strategy in terms of, you've mentioned a lot of the activities that you guys do. You know, I heard you say cyber gym even. So things like that, it's a unique value proposition. And at the same time, it allows organizations that you partner with to tap into talent that not necessarily, you know, sitting on a bench or available readily for another engagement. Share some thoughts from that perspective with us.
So, I mean, as we're, you know, unwinding from a global pandemic, right? There were a lot of people in the country that were displaced, right? You know, in the background in my brain, that pause of, you know, coming to work in place every day has like thrust automation and like, you know, which in theory is going to make people less employable, right? The more and more we, you know, I think of McDonald's, right? You go to McDonald's now, the person behind the counter is becoming non-existent because there is now a screen that I'm doing. So as the jobs change, and COVID, I think, sped that process up quite a bit for companies, there are a lot of people that are out there that are going to have to go out, find new skills in a different way, you know, and look at, okay, how do I pivot to what I would, you know, what we reference is either a pandemic resilient career, you know, or some sort of, you know, resiliency in their skill set that makes them marketable, regardless of what global economic situations happen or global, you know, pandemics happen. So, you know, we found a lot of, you know, career transitioners that were coming into our program during the height of COVID. They were trying to figure out, okay, I'm here, you know, banking's changing. Do I want to go back into this space? You know, how do I find those new skills? And there's lots of great pathways that are to do it. Generally for the past, you know, forever, you know, I find myself in a situation, I'm going to go pick college, right? I'm going to go get a master's degree or something to upskill myself. And it's going to take me a little bit longer. So things like boot camps or pre-apprenticeship is a really good vessel to help kind of bridge that gap in a shorter, more cost-effective way for individuals to retrain. Specific to the question just around training, right? So we've had a couple iterations around our apprenticeship model and just how we've done pre-apprenticeship. When we first started this 5 years ago, you know, we were finding highly motivated people that maybe found themselves displaced, like I just described, and were going to employers with very little skill set for these folks or any type of pre-training saying, hey, we're going to teach them on the job. You know, they would get a job, they start working it, get additional skills. They would carve out time in their work week to, you know, for that additional kind of upskilling or training. What we found really quickly is that that was a really hard pill for companies. You know, the non-degree is already a hard pill. Now we're stacking on, hey, this person has no skills, no certs that are transferable in that space. So we had to, you know, we had to go back to the drawing board. We added the idea of pre-apprenticeship to get somebody into, you know, like, if anything that's important, just a pre-apprenticeship, a certification means I come into your place of employment, you and I are having a meeting, and we simply understand the words that each other are saying. If I'm making a transition from banking into cybersecurity, that vernacular is incredibly different, and I'm going to have to Google and write down every third word. So we're going to have very long meetings for my first, you know, 3 or 4 months. So add a pre-apprenticeship. You know, bolster that individual skills, and it's really taking the program to the next level for those individuals. So cobbling some cert training, some hard skills are important, right? The idea of the cyber gym. I think the hardest part for individuals, whether they go through our program or somebody else, is like, how do I show you my skills, right? Like, there's not, if I'm a coder, I can get a GitHub account, I can create some code, create an app, and I can show that to somebody because it's easier to demonstrate that function of coding. In the cyber world, it's a little bit harder, right? Because there's not that type of concrete product creation that's there. But I can still get those skills through things like competitions, much like Power Up Cyber Games, Hack the Box, Try Hack Me, where I can continue to like show those things and maybe earn some certificates of complete of participation. So, you know, beyond just the hard skills, it shows in a potential hire or employer, like, I care about this. I want to learn. I'm doing these things to do it. And it makes them more employable for that individual.
So for your organization, and it seems like you've built that culture of innovation to continuously reinvent yourself and innovate not only the products, but also the services and internal processes on how you guys operate. I'm always fascinated just overall with the topic of innovation. And one of my favorite books out there is by my former professor, Experimentation Matters. And he talks a lot about innovation in the form of experiments, where organizations take on these internal experiments, so to say, prototyping almost. Share your thoughts on your views of innovation. How do you go about that when it comes to fostering that culture at your organization? And moreover, when you work with your client, companies, and they are trying to at least foster that culture of innovation, yep, as well. What are some advice that you have? What are practical recommendations you subscribe to?
I mean, I could soapbox on the nonprofit saga for hours and days, right? You know, for example, we're literally the only sector in the world that describes ourselves by what we are not, right? Like, we're nonprofit. So anytime somebody asks me what I do for a living, I say, well, I run a nonprofit. They're like, well, how do you make money? Like, we're still a business, right? Like, there's still a business aspect. There's revenue and salaries and payroll, and just, you know, the biggest difference is, you know, it's a tax classification and I don't have shareholders. I'm not, people on my board aren't making money, or I'm not, there's not profit margins there that are, you know, paying dividends or something to investors. So it's really the biggest difference. So, you know, that one soapbox probably being the biggest. And then, you know, with that mindset for me, you know, there's, you know, I don't fancy myself a Sarah McLaughlin sad dog person. It's like going to try to come to somebody and like give you a sob story of why you should give me money. Like, that's not how I particularly operate. Like, and that works. Don't get me wrong. No, nobody wants to see a sick dog, and we all want to give money or support kids or families because it's all important work. So, you know, with that, it sounds horrible. Totally came out wrong, but none of that is bad. But for us, you know, we want to look at it from tactical, practical ways. How do we help serve people to provide them pathways to prosperity? How do we help youth to show them, you know, this is career fields that you could be? We adopted the Traction model, so the entrepreneurial operating system at CyberUp. Our strategic plan was starting to, you know, was coming to an end. We were looking at, you know, what does the next 2 to 3 to 5 years look like as an organization? You know, I've been paid, you know, as a nonprofit consultant to do strategic plan for organizations. And oftentimes they're a 25, 30 page, you know, monstrosity of a document that has, you know, fancy SWOT analysis and all these other like charts and metrics, but they just generally go up on a shelf and they're printed and they're not actionable. So we looked at the EOS model, which is, you know, 2 pages, and these are your values. This is your mission. This is your value proposition. These are the goals we're working on for the year. We're going to divide those up into quarterly. So it, you know, it does have a long-term approach, but breaks that down into very bite-sized actionable things that we as an organization, I mean, we're a team of 7, right? So we're not huge. We're, you know, it's kind of lean and mean, but we can all block and tackle those kind of priorities and goals and not overextend ourselves to not be able to do those kind of things. So, you know, that part I would say for us is innovation. And I think just specific to program stuff, right? Like, we launched Power Up Cyber Games because of, you know, things that we saw we needed to address just to help get kids and students excited. Educators, teachers, right? Like, they're not cybersecurity professionals. Like, nobody's going to expect them to go out and learn cybersecurity stuff. So we had to create a platform that made that fairly easy for them and not scary, right? Scary being the biggest thing. I'm already busy. Imagine, I have such tremendous respect for educators over the past 2 years of navigating virtual school and teaching, you know, 5-year-olds kindergarten on a Zoom. That sounds horrendous to me. You know, how do you corral 35-year-olds, you know, into a Zoom and teach to do it? So we wanted to create a platform that was more user-friendly and allowed a teacher to facilitate more than lead. So that was one. And then specifically around the apprenticeship program for us, we had to get creative, right, of how companies were thinking about how they were hiring and saying, hey, this is the value apprenticeship brings to you, right? Every person who comes to your organization can benefit from a 1-year structured onboarding plan, right? Like, that's a win for that person because they're going to have, you know, an end goal in mind. Your hiring managers are going to benefit from having that structure for that individual, so they're not alone and trying to figure out how to make it work for that person. And then trying to figure out the business end, right, of how you kind of fit that within a corporate construct of hiring. So we were able to kind of pivot and package it in a way, you know, that makes all that a kind of a one-stop solution or an easy button, if you will, to do it really, really well.
In a fully virtual environment, fully maybe even some hybrid capacities that organizations are currently operating under, especially in the past couple of years, when it comes to onboarding candidates virtually or even in the hybrid environment, you know, candidate onboarding is a very complex space to begin with, but when you add another layer of complexity of doing that completely virtually, is another challenge on its own. What are your thoughts on that as you work with organizations of various size and some are more successful than the other when it comes to onboarding candidates virtually? What are some of the recommendations you have? What are some of the observations that you make when you work both on both sides of the equation with the candidates and with the hiring organizations?
I mean, it's really hard to make, you know, I think that that in-person nature, right? Cybersecurity is a team sport. So that virtual nature takes that away. It's harder to make that, right? Like if I'm going to equate it to the NFL, right? COVID hit. You know, they were doing training camps on Zoom calls, right? They weren't on a field. They weren't high-fiving or fist bumping or doing that stuff, right? So like that that virtual nature of even hiring for a cybersecurity person, you know, comparing that to NFL, two very different animals. However, the parallel there, I think, is hard. How do you create that intentionality of teamwork and make that person feel the nice warm hug, right, that they're part of it? I mean, I've seen a lot of companies, a lot of times it comes down to stuff, right? Like you get a job day one, here's your like cool welcome kit, right? That's all swagged out with logos and coffee cups and shirts. Like that's one way, you know, some people appreciate that, some don't. You know, I know we went down the whole virtual happy hour things. It's, you know, I don't know that I have a silver bullet. I know those things help because it makes you feel part of that organization, right? That there's a, you cared enough to send me something and you cared enough to like give me a nice warm hug and feel part of something larger. Cause that's what we all want, right? We want to be part of a team that has a common vision. So like, I would say that is a pretty, is a solid way. You know, consistency and just conversations and meeting with a new hire. That's hard, right? Like we're busy, but I know for us that we had to learn, you know, as we went remote, like it's easy when I'm sitting next to, you know, I'll use my chief of staff, Amber. She's been with me almost 6 years. We shared an office. So if I ever had an issue, I just like holler across the office. Right? Like, hey, what's up? What do you think about this? And like with the virtual nature, a lot of times I'm just not going to have those discussions because we're not sitting next to each other. But having that level of attention, I'm like, you know what? I'm stuck. I'm going to get 10 minutes on your calendar. You know, we'll hop on a Zoom call. You know, that that kind of, it's bumped my personal like just line of thinking, but I think it's a really important part for that first, you know, that a hiring manager knows I'm going to have to invest some time, energy, and you know my own resources into this to maybe take those times, do daily check-ins. What are you working on? What do you need to make sure that they have that level of success that they all want? And that small investment up front makes that person feel warm and welcomed and invited, heard. And I think it's going to, you know, as things start to spread out, you know, need the frequency of that, they have a solid foundation to grow and build on for the team.
Right, right. Absolutely. Those are definitely very interesting observations. When it comes to interviewing, that's also another space that's very, very, very difficult to master because a lot of, I view that as a lot of interviews are based on that. What are the weaknesses that I can tolerate in a candidate versus what are the strengths missing on my team? And just overall ability to create that two-way street, that conversation and give even the candidate an opportunity to make their own determination, then ask their own questions and see if you're the type of leader I want to strive under, or is this the type of culture I can be successful in? What are your thoughts on just improving that space? What are some of the recommendations you provide to both sides, to candidates and to hiring managers to get better at?
That's a great question because it's hard, right? I mean, hiring in general across the board is a difficult thing right now, right? Like I was on a call earlier today with a large financial institution in St. Louis that is going back to the office on Monday, right? 2,000 people. Back to the office, which is, you know, I imagine half the people think that's the greatest thing since sliced bread, and probably the other half are dreading the fact of putting on pants and not wearing sweatpants, you know, to work and like completely disrupting their life. So it's just, we're in a very strange time to hire. I know for us, and I think what's helped a little bit, I'm a ridiculously honest person, and you know, to my demise, it's good and it's bad. But I try to paint as realistic of a picture for that person I'm interviewing of like, this is the job, this is the expectations. They can kind of really map that out in a think, in a good and intentional way for them, so they can get a sense, one, of the job itself, a little bit about our organization and culture, right? Because if they get to know me, like, the, you know, and our team, hopefully they can pick up the vibe. It's harder in Zoom, right? I'm an animated dude and I whip my hands around. Body language is, you know, is a thing. But I think, you know, it requires a little bit more honesty up front, some expectation setting, and I think, you know, a little bit more intentionality in that discussion for a company. And then for those that are, you know, looking, I think you're going to have to come with just, you know, really solid, direct questions, you know, and if there's something you feel like you're not getting addressed, like, just ask, right? Like, I think it's only going to serve you better if you're asking, like, you know, do you foresee us going back in the office? What is our future work going to look like? Right. Like, you wouldn't want to take a job that's remote right now, and then, you know, a month later realize, crap, I'm going to have to go back in the office now. And that really wasn't what I wanted. I was talking to my former board president who rolled off a few weeks ago. And it never really dawned on me, but I know, like, he, you know, he runs a, you know, couple $100 million defense contracting company here, and the remote nature jobs in today's day and age is having a huge impact on his business, right? These East Coast, West Coast companies are coming up and snagging people in the Midwest, you know, and some really smart, bright talent, because it cost them a lot less money here, and they just let them work remote. So, like, not, you know, predominantly local companies just, you know, competed locally with those individuals. But now with COVID and remote work being more of the norm, it's definitely changed landscape for all, for everybody, and have to change and relook how they're, you know, onboarding and hiring people.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's, you know, we could probably spend a whole episode dedicated to that particular space, because it's just, it's difficult, it's challenging, and at the same time, there's a lot of moving parts to that. But moving on to, you know, your content diet, what are the services that you consume on a daily basis to keep yourself educated, keep yourself informed in the space that you operate in?
One, and maybe I should be ashamed to say this, I love football. So NFL Network is a pretty heavy dose of content right now. You know, I look at they're a marketing machine that is able to engage grown folk, right, and people who are fans for 365 days a year in a sport that doesn't go 365 days a year. It continues to impress me of, like, it's now free agency frenzy. So they've got all this great content that they're able to drive out. So, you know, NFL being one of them. And sadly, I am a Jaguars fan. Not a proud moment, but when the Rams move, I had to find a new team. Other than that, I'm always looking for good book recommendations, right? I find, you know, I am not a, you know, full disclosure, an avid reader, but I have a tendency to gravitate toward more books like Patrick Lencioni type of books. Love, you know, his content, because it's, you know, it's fiction, it's short reads, it can capture my attention, and the storytelling behind it, I think, is really, really good. You know, all of the traction, the Geno Wickman books, that, you know, do digest a lot of that EOS strategy around the roles of integrators, visionaries, and I think that's a, you know, great way for us. And then, you know, last but not least, just, you know, from, as a nonprofit, you know, leader, you know, staying up on trends of nonprofit things and understanding what is working and what isn't working, right? As we all pivoted, you know, nonprofits across the country who, you know, host this large, massive fundraisers that raised, you know, a couple $100,000, $500,000 a year for them went away with COVID. So, like, how do you make up $500,000 of revenue if you're a $2 million a year organization? So, you know, find myself reading a lot of that information, just trying to, you know, stay ahead of trends and stuff within the nonprofit space.
You've mentioned books. Is there, you know, Lencioni's books are always, you know, those are classics. Is there a book that you always recommend to others, and why is that?
I love Getting Naked by Patrick Lencioni. You know, it always sounds funny to say the title, but, you know, the idea of authenticity is important to me, right? I do follow a lot of Gary Vee. I know he's a polarizing guy, but, like, you know, I curse a lot. You know, 9 years Army, it's hard for me not to curse. So this might be the longest I think I've ever gone without saying a bad word. You know, but I hear him, and I think of just, I find him authentic, right? his leadership style, his demeanor of how he, you know, frequently inserts F-bombs into his discussion. I don't feel like it's a forced thing for him or like it's just part of his brand, but I think it's just his authentic self. So, you know, that book, Getting Naked by Patrick Lencioni, really does a good job of storing that tale of authenticity and how it is a differentiator from you, from another company or organization. And just the storytelling behind that, I think, has stuck with me for a long time.
I love those recommendations. And for our listeners, we'll make those titles available in the show notes. Tony, I can't thank you enough for your time today. Very short and insightful conversation. What I love doing with all the guests on the podcast is do a follow-up recording in about a year where we revisit the conversation from a year ago and see if everything we've discussed still makes sense, still applies. So those are a lot of fun, and I'm looking forward to doing that with you as well.
I'm in a soapbox for a second here, if I can. And for those that are listening, we're in a really strange time, mm-hmm. right? You know, COVID aside, you know, we're the first time ever to have four different generations of humans in the workforce, right? Your boomers and your Gen X's and your millennials and your Gen Z'ers. You know, because we're a nonprofit and we hang out in workforce, right? We use this idea of soft skills all the time. You know, what is your definition of soft skills? What is my definition of soft skills? Like, our crossroads are boomers have very different ideas of soft skills than Gen Z and millennials. So are we best served to, like, as older workers, to make people change to our standards? Do we mold to their standards? Like, that part is one thing that really kind of sticks in my brain. I don't have a good answer. Maybe somebody who's listening, like, ping me, you know, drop my information. I'm interested in that. Are we ready for this Gen Z generation, you know, who looks at their life in blocks of time of careers, right? Like, we had a young man who came and hung out with you. I'm going to have seven careers in my life, right? Seven distinct careers. The days and age of somebody going to a company and staying for 30, 35 years, it's done. What are we doing as companies to adjust to that, you know, that mindset? And then just this idea of, like, I don't have to go to college for success. Are we making the right choices and decisions as large corporations or small companies to adapt to that mindset? And do we have the right tools and resources? And are we equipping our talent acquisition and HR folks to be creative and nimble, and supporting them the way we need to? I don't have a good answer. I hope we have a good solution, a good answer for those two things, because those are really critical to the future of our workforce. You know, this gig economy has definitely made a huge impact, I think, on just the great resignation, right? Like, why do I want to go work for you for 40 hours a week when I could go and, you know, go to Marshall's, buy some crap, sell it on Amazon or eBay and make 25, 30 bucks a sweatshirt, you know, and have the same amount of revenue, or create an Etsy account? Like, that's other companies aren't necessarily our competition anymore. It's those type of roles and functions where people don't want to go work for somebody, and I could go do that stuff and have the same quality of life or a better quality of life, but the same revenue and income stream for that piece. So, total soapbox. Thanks for letting me ramble. But it's one of those things, like, those are things that I'm laying in bed and going to bed at night thinking to myself, what the heck is going to happen in the next 5-10 years? What do my kids' careers look like, you know, in the next 5-10 years? And I don't know.
Oh, that scares me. Yeah, I can relate. I can relate on so many levels. Very powerful thoughts. I appreciate you sharing that. Tony, thanks so much for making time for us. I really appreciate it.
I appreciate the time to be on the podcast. Thanks so much.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.